Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The U.S.-China relationship has emerged as one of the most important foreign policy challenges for the United States in the 21st century. China's economic prowess is providing a launching pad for increased diplomatic, trade, and security ties with countries around the world. And China is also asserting its powers on its neighbors with a more assertive foreign policy, navy, and most recently the controversial construction of artificial islands in the South China Sea in the midst of one of the world's busiest sea lanes. Today we hear from one of America's top specialists on China's political and security policies who spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Dean Cheng is the Heritage Foundation's Senior Research Fellow on Chinese Political and Security Affairs. He's written extensively on China's military doctrine, technology, space program, and the dual-use issues associated with the nation's industrial and scientific infrastructure. Prior to joining the Heritage Foundation, Cheng worked with the Science Applications International Corporation and the China Studies Division for the Center for Naval Analysis. And prior to that, worked at the Office of Technology Assessment, studying China's defense industrial complex. He's appeared on public affairs programs regularly and been interviewed or provided commentary for publications such as Time, The Washington Post, The Financial Times, Bloomberg News, and Jane's Defense Weekly, to name a few. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night and my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Dean Cheng, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Last night you spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations on what you call the three knots, and it regards the United States' relationship with China and how it's changing in the early 21st century. And you said there are three knots. Asia is not Europe. China is not the Soviet Union. That's good news. And this is not your father's People's Liberation Army.
Yes.
Tell us about these three knots. Let's start with the first one, that okay. Asia is not Europe.
When we say that Asia is not Europe, what we're trying to get at is a couple of things. The first is that the Cold War isn't over in Asia. Just because the wall came down and the Soviet Union dissolved, which did end the Cold War in Europe, in Asia we continue to see nations that are divided, at least nominally, along ideological lines. The two Koreas remain divided, a communist North, a capitalist democratic South. China is divided along the Taiwan Straits between China, ruled by the Communist Party there, and Taiwan, which is a democracy, about to have new elections early next year. So that's one part. Another part to this is that Asia has much more uncertain borders. There are a lot of territorial disputes. Not all of them involve China, between Japan and Russia, between Japan and South Korea, among a variety of states in the South China Sea. And third is that history plays an enormous set of considerations, which in turn means that you really don't have overarching architectures. There's no European Union, no European Economic Community, no NATO counterparts in Asia. So that really means that when we look at Asia, we're looking at a very different security environment and also economic environment than we are when we're looking at Europe. When we look at Asia, we see a place where bilateral U.S. relations with key allies, Japan, South Korea, Philippines, Thailand, Australia, and special bilateral relationships with places like Taiwan and Singapore play a very, very important role, but there's no overarching sort of one-size-fits-all place to go.
Let's talk about those border disputes. You know, the landscape of these countries have been set for a number of years. Why are there still border disputes that seem to be simmering? They're not sort of addressed through overt violent action. There might be some skirmishes on some of those. But why are there so many border disputes in this area as opposed to Europe or Africa or South America?
Well, actually, I think there are a number of border disputes in almost all of these places except Europe. But in Europe, you had, in part because it was bipolar, nuclear-armed, superpower-backed, everybody sort of agreed that going to war over territory was a really bad idea that could rapidly escalate out of control. So you had the Helsinki Accords, which, among other things, basically said the borders as they are currently constituted in the mid-1970s when the treaty was signed, that is the end of the debate. So Alsace-Lorraine is French. Doesn't matter, you know, whether you happen to like that conclusion or not, it is French and no one's going to fight over this. And that's actually part of, interestingly, why the whole business with Ukraine is so serious, is because it's the first time really since the end of World War II that we are seeing in Europe someone trying to change those boundaries and those borders. In Asia, again, in part because you didn't have the kind of overarching architecture, you didn't have the same kind of threats.
You didn't have two world wars, for example. I mean, you had world wars, but they weren't over territory in that sense.
It wasn't along those same lines, and you didn't have that same scale of fighting. And actually, this also goes to that in Asia, it's maritime, which is a different type of problem. But these territorial issues are rooted also in other aspects of history that in some ways have been resolved in Europe. The issue of Tokto or Takeshima between Japan and South Korea is at least as much rooted in deeper problems between Seoul and Tokyo as it is over this specific island. You have bigger issues of potential resources, again, because in part this is a maritime question. So what is under the seabed? And also the fish in the sea. People often don't realize just how important fishing resources are. The South China Sea is at least as much about fish and very rich fishing grounds as it is about, you know, individual specific islands.
We have to remember fisheries around the world are under stress, too.
Yes.
Yeah. So Asia is not Europe. China is not the Soviet Union. And that on the surface sounds like a good thing, because when we think of the Soviet Union, we think of a direct ideological struggle between the West and the East, as it was in the Cold War. Is that a good thing that China is not the Soviet Union?
I'm not sure whether it's good or bad. It more sort of just is. But it plays to both ends. On the one hand, you had a Soviet Union, nuclear-armed global power with a messianic ideology that wanted to spread its ideology everywhere. But at the same time was economically autarkic or isolationist. It didn't trade with anyone. China is different in almost every way. It's still a regional military power, not a global military power. It is not particularly ideological in the sense that it is not trying to spread Chinese communism everywhere. It's much more interested in exporting T-shirts, washing machines, and computers than dialectics. But it also is, as a result, economically linked to everyone out there. It is the world's largest trading power. It has eclipsed the United States. And so the downside, if you want to view it that way, is that we could contain the Soviet Union in part because it didn't cost us anything. And what I mean by that is that you didn't have interest groups who were, in a sense, whose interests lay in expanding relations with the USSR. When you're economically autarkic, the bad news is you're not creating people who are customers. When you're China, if people are talking about containing China, you're talking about containing one of the biggest markets out there for soybeans, for oil drilling parts, for airliners. So this is not the sort of thing that you could easily do. And that's not just an issue of America. It's bauxite from Australia. It's lithium and copper from Bolivia. It is bananas from the Philippines. I mean, containment has a much more real financial cost in the context of China than it did with the Soviet Union.
Is it even feasible to think of containment when you look at the size of China's economy, the size of its population, and versus the United States and the West? I mean, I think it's kind of unfeasible, isn't it?
It would be enormously difficult. It would require some kind of mobilizing event that all of us, and by us I mean the West, the U.S., Europe, Japan, South Korea, all of these other countries, all agreed upon that it was hugely game-changing. In that kind of situation, though, we're talking also about a China that has done something that really sort of moves it away from where we are now to one where China is much more like the Soviet Union. So that sort of, if you completely reshuffle the deck, things are possible. But looking at it right now, it would be very hard to imagine.
And yet, after building its economic prowess, China is beginning to assert its diplomatic security footprint beyond its borders. And I think this gets to your third knot, which is that this is not the your father's PLA or People's Liberation Army. What do you mean by that?
Many people, I think, still have this idea that the Chinese military values quantity above all else, that
over quality.
Certainly over quality. Yeah. This goes back to the Mao era. The idea was that the Chinese had so many troops that you would run out of bullets before they ran out of bodies. But today's People's Liberation Army is a very different entity. It emphasizes quality. The senior leadership, political leadership, has told the PLA that you must become a military that is intense in science and technology, that does, puts S&T firepower, that sort of thing, above simple quantity. As careful students of other people's wars, since China hasn't fought a war itself since 1979, it has paid very close attention to how, in particular, the United States fights its wars, and in many ways is trying to attain comparable capabilities, certainly in the same types of domains, outer space, cyberspace, that the U.S. has long considered sort of its personal area of specialty.
Right. Now, you did mention, though, that you consider China a regional military power as opposed to a global. Is that changing at all?
Well, in terms of the physical domains of land, sea, and air, China is definitely still a regional military power. China doesn't have the base infrastructure that the U.S. or even the Soviet Union did in terms of global presence. The Soviets maintained a fleet in the Mediterranean. The Soviets maintained a fleet in the Indian Ocean. We don't see any of that from the Chinese. We have three ships on rotation to the Indian Ocean. So there's been a small Chinese naval task force assigned to combat pirates. That's been going on for several years. They rotate three ships there. And they have peacekeeping formations in places, small ones, in places like Lebanon and Haiti and elsewhere, but not the basing. On the other hand, when you think about outer space and cyberspace, it's not really a regional capability. It is by definition global. Space is everything beyond the atmosphere. So in that regard, China is developing those kinds of capabilities. In the future, should it physically want to be able to operate more globally, those capabilities will come even more into play. But even now, as a regional military power, it is emphasizing the use of space and cyber for things like targeting and disruptive operations.
Yeah. Now, the biggest security threat in here in the last couple of months has been this construction of artificial islands in the South China Sea. You mentioned the importance of the South China Sea, not only for its possible mineral riches at the bottom of the oceans, but also the fisheries. How does this artificial islands, and it's very evident that this is the People's Liberation Army, it's certainly the military that's constructing these islands and are going to utilize these islands. How does this affect the security of that region?
Well, this is a very, very complex region. So you have not only China making claims, but Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, the Philippines, and Taiwan. The Chinese and Taiwan claims actually are largely the same in terms of physical limitations there, delimitations. But so this is a multilateral problem. On top of that, you have some of the world's most important waterways. This is really the carotid artery of global trade. $5.3 trillion of trade passes through these waters every year. So what China is doing is it is, first off, manipulating international law. It is taking reefs, which are submerged. It's building islands on top of them. And then with that is saying, hey, this is now an island. An island extends certain territorial waters and certain exclusive economic zones. And so you have to respect all of that.
All of a sudden, that's part of their 12-mile limit.
Part of their 12-mile limit, part of their 200-mile exclusive economic zone. And the way the Chinese treat EEZs is also very different and, again, is trying to change the concept of international law. And EEZ, by everyone else's definition, is international waters where you, the claiming state, have exclusive economic rights, fishing, drilling. But otherwise, it's international waters. The Chinese attitude is, no. This is a lot like territorial waters, except you get to sail through them. And by the way, you have to file flight plans or announce you're sailing. It's a fundamentally different attitude. The reason why this becomes an issue is, one, of course, it overlaps with a lot of other people's claims. Two, as they militarize these islands, as they're building airstrips and the like, it is to enforce both the territorial waters claim and the EEZ claim. And it then poses a real question, not just to the specific resources, but to freedom of navigation. That's where the United States comes in.
It's obviously, I mean, in a crisis situation, it becomes a choke point.
It becomes a choke point. But even in peacetime, by making these demands, by trying to manipulate international law, China is trying to change the concept of freedom of navigation. And that's why the U.S. has consistently said, we take no position on who owns this or that island. But these are international waters that anyone and everyone can fly through and sail through, and we are going to continue to fly and sail through these waters.
And we have been doing that. I think there was a CNN report last month in which the military is basically saying, you're in our airspace, you know, announce yourself, that sort of thing, and we're basically ignoring that, aren't we?
Yes, we are. But as the Chinese build these bases, as the Chinese clearly are preparing to start deploying military forces to those islands, it's going to become ever riskier. The CNN report, for example, was from a patrol aircraft. These are very large, lumbering, converted airliners, essentially. They don't really have any kind of air combat capability. So right now, when you sail or fly through this area aboard one of those, you know, you're broadcasting radio commentary. But if a fighter plane actually showed up, now everyone's going to be a lot more nervous. And that's part of the Chinese strategy, I think, here is to basically say, well, we have fighter planes that can now be based here. So how risky do you want to be?
Yeah. What's the reaction from the other nations with territorial claims in this South China Sea? What are they doing at this particular point?
What they're mostly doing is building up their own militaries and looking to the United States for help in leadership. I was just at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. This is one of the annual big conferences on Asian security. And speaker after speaker, defense ministers from across the region, actually around the world, even from Germany and the UK, were all basically saying to the Chinese delegates, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? How far is this going to go? And then to the United States was saying, we need your help in coordinating a response, and we look to you as the biggest power out there to tell the Chinese with us that this has got to stop.
What are we doing at this point? What is our reaction?
Well, our reaction thus far has been to do the overflights, to sail ships within the 12 nautical mile limit. The real question is going to be, again, what happens as the Chinese expand their presence, escalate their capabilities? We are selling more modern equipment to the Philippines. We've arranged to sell some things to Vietnam. We're expanding our military cooperation programs with the various states in the region. But nobody wants to go to war over this. And so while one could, in theory, say, well, you could solve this problem by just blowing up the islands, that really would be an act of war. And no one is suggesting that as an actual policy option. The problem here is, as a result, the Chinese, like us, are basically saying, well, okay, then I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing, and it's up to you to decide what you think you might want to do to stop me.
It's very interesting. My guest today is Dean Ching, the Senior Research Fellow, a specialist on China for the Heritage Foundation. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Now, you've been writing also about some of the other areas. You mentioned the anti-piracy efforts, and I think you had an article about how from Djibouti to Antarctica, China is expanding its reach. Now, in Djibouti, we should mention there's a number of countries that have people stationed there. It's all about anti-piracy and along that coastline. But Antarctica, that's interesting. I really did not know that they were expanding so much to Antarctica.
Well, in Antarctica, China is, I believe, second only to the United States and maybe Australia in terms of having manned stations on and around Antarctica. They're building new ones. So they are also investing significant money into Antarctic research. So there's a couple of different factors here. One is that the Chinese leadership has said a great power has to contribute to the global pool of knowledge. And this is an effort to help expand our understanding of the seventh continent, which is remarkably understudied.
Yeah.
But another piece to this, we think, is that if ever Antarctic resources were opened up for exploitation, and they're talking about renegotiating the Antarctic Treaty in the coming decade or so, China wants to be in a position to say, we have a major presence here. We cannot be excluded. It's interesting to note that at the other end of the world, China has been pushing for membership in the Arctic Council, even though it doesn't actually touch on the Arctic. And there it makes the interesting argument that the Arctic is a resource for all mankind. And since China has 1.3 billion people, which is a good hunk of mankind, it has a right to sit in on that. Now, it does have observer status, but a number of countries have observer status. But China would like to elevate itself beyond that.
It sounds like, you know, China's taking all the steps that a country would do as it has newfound wealth relatively over the last 20, 30 years. They're asserting those economic rights into other spheres in which they have traditionally not been a part of.
Yes. China sort of reminds me of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous comment, you know, better to be nouveau riche than not riche at all. So, yes, China is definitely expanding its participation, its role, its global footprint, if you will, and going much more beyond military. This is, in fact, the military, while it is expanding it more accurately, it's modernizing. It is in the diplomatic, the cultural, the science and technology, and, of course, the economic areas that China is pushing hardest to basically say, we are a major power and we will not be ignored.
Yeah. And in many places, they're inserting their influence by aid in a way that the United States really isn't so much anymore.
Aid is part of it. Also, just plain old investment. So we see, for example, what the Chinese have termed the One Belt, One Road initiative, creating a maritime Silk Road with new port facilities from the Straits of Malacca across the Indian Ocean through the Red Sea up into Eastern Europe, as well as the new Silk Road on land with pipelines, railways, and the like from Central Asia all the way over to Greece and Turkey.
We mentioned territorial disputes, maritime territorial disputes. There are also long simmering territorial disputes on land between India and China. Certainly, the U.S. administration has been opening new inroads with India. I'm not sure as a counterweight, I think that's part of it, but also for economic reasons. But how does that work in this sort of triangle between the United States, India, and China, these two very populous countries and our country?
Well, the India-China relationship is a remarkably complex one. It's important to remember that the two countries fought a war back in 1962 over territory. And so there's always been this sort of uneasy relationship. China is India's, I believe, largest trading partner. There's something like $40 billion worth of trade between these two countries. But at the same time, the Indian military clearly sees China as one of their major security concerns. Now, the triangle relationship that's most important from a security perspective actually doesn't involve the United States. It involves Pakistan. China and Pakistan are very closely aligned, arguably allied. China supplies Pakistan with large amounts of military equipment, missiles, and the like. And, of course, India-Pakistan relations have
always
long
been
yes,
terrible.
Very, very bad. So if you're the Indian military, you look at the situation and you see a possible three-front conflict, Pakistan to the northwest, China to the northeast, but also the growing Chinese Navy and its presence in the Indian Ocean poses potential threats to India's sea lanes of communications. Where does the U.S. fit into this? We're becoming a larger arms supplier to India. We've tried to facilitate Indian access to peaceful nuclear technology. China sees this as remarkably unfair. You know, why are you helping the Indians? Another interesting problem here is the Russia-India-China relationship, because Russia supplies arms to both sides. And if you're Beijing, one of the things that you're very unhappy about with Moscow is the fact that Russia actually supplies better weapons to India than it's willing to supply to China. It supplies the same basic fighter plane to both countries, but the MKI edition, if you will, has better radars, better capabilities than the MKK edition that is sold to China.
Interesting. And you all have to remember that the Soviet Union also had a long relationship with India as well.
Exactly. And yeah, that was in part
because Pakistan was the United States.
That's
it
right.
Goes back to Cold War.
But also the Soviet Union and China were also at odds. And so helping India was, again, another way of for Moscow to balance against Beijing. What we are, in fact, seeing is the return of great power politics. The U.S. remains primus inter pares, first among equals. But what you are seeing is shifting alignments, shifting coalitions, where everybody has all sorts of domestic interests And today I'm friends with you to counter him, and tomorrow I'm going to be allied with him to counter you.
Exactly. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. In many senses, this is, and it's actually been sold as this, is a way to make sure that China doesn't write the trade rules for this particular region. And of course, last week it was rebuffed by the House of Representatives. This week it did pass, and it looks like, you know, it's still no sure thing. I mean, this is just the fast-tracked authority. It's not even the agreement yet. How is China using this sort of internal debate in the United States about whether to participate in this partnership against the U.S. to these countries and the region?
American politics is inscrutable, shall we say, to many, many outsiders and, frankly, even to many of us from Washington. That being said, the issue here, if you are in the region, is tell me how this all ends. Because if all this winds up with a TPP that is ratified and signed and agreed upon, all of this will basically fall into the background as, wow, those Americans, they always keep us on the edge of our seats. If it doesn't go through, if TPP fails, then I think the Chinese will be pointing to this as evidence that apparently the Americans are no longer especially interested in free trade. The Americans are unable to forge a working coalition, and the Americans, therefore, really are unqualified to be leaders. On the other hand, the Chinese will say, we are here. We are your major trading partner. We have suggested the Regional Common Economic Plan, the RCEP. But the point is, you know, their version of a free trade agreement, which really simply says that those areas where we currently have low tariffs will stay low, and that's pretty much about all that's going to happen. But the Chinese will present that as, see, we can lead. We can manage.
We're predictable.
We are predictable. We do what we say we're going to do. And in the larger context, then, the question is, when the United States has talked about a pivot to Asia, we have emphasized this, not just the military. It's economic. It's diplomatic. So a failure on something as big as TPP is a failure for a broad pivot to Asia. And the Chinese will say, we are your future, and you really don't want to make us unhappy, whether that's economically, territorially, or security-wise.
So it sounds like it's a very dangerous game we're playing, at least because there is this debate over whether a Trans-Pacific Partnership is in the United States' best interest. There's a, you know, ongoing debate on whether that free trade agreement is in the United States' best interest or not. And yet we're continuing to negotiate. We're probably going to have a final treaty here within months if all goes well. And that treaty, in essence, is saying the United States wants this, and yet it has to go through Congress or at least the Senate to be ratified.
Well, ratification protocols and processes and all of that are a longstanding part of American policy. As I said, it is often difficult to understand, especially if you're not an American. And it's very, very difficult to predict, whether you're an American or not, about how that's going to turn out. Part of the issue here is that, again, from a strategic security perspective, which TPP is not specifically focused on, it's an economic treaty, but it is open to being exploited, failure in particular is open to being exploited by the Chinese, as from a security perspective, it highlights American unreliability. Yes, there are lots of debates depending on where you're coming from, you know, party-wise, job-wise, labor versus, you know,
business.
Management,
yeah.
Business, lots of different perspectives. But what I'm talking about here is that from a security perspective with regards to the Chinese, there's this additional factor that does need to be taken into consideration.
Dean Chang is the Heritage Foundation's Senior Research Fellow on Chinese Political and Security Affairs and was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.